Then along came Instagram, and now we didn't even have to bother writing out those few words. We could just post a picture instead. Next, Snapchat made it so that we could only look at those pictures for a few seconds. Who knows, by the time this book comes out, there'll be some new form of interaction that will save us even more time. And that idea just might have been born that day in that luxury bathroom. After all, these were the innovators changing the ways we communicate with each other, conduct business with each other, connect to each other. They turned our cell phones into remote control devices of the wide, wide world, allowing us to start our cars, monitor our homes, transfer funds, transmit documents, watch the State of the Union address, and track the locations of our teenage children, and pretty much everything else besides. Thanks to them, we could point this little device at whatever we want, whenever we want, and it connects us to anyone, anything, right away. Really, there was more energy and excitement in that one hotel bathroom than I'd ever experienced under one roof. And we stayed there talking until 4 o'clock the next morning. We all had some place we needed to be in the morning, but nobody wanted to leave. The conversation was like this living, breathing organism, and had taken on a life of its own. At one point, we started talking about self-driving cars. But the talk wasn't so much about how or when we'll see this type of innovation, but how long it'll be before it's illegal for human beings to drive at all. That's how close we are to seeing this type of change transform the way we work and live. Get with the program. We want what we want when we want it, right? And these are the people sitting on the bathroom floor in the tub who are going to see that we get it in 5 years, 10 years, whatever the case may be. All of this is basically a drum roll as we reach the end of the book. My way of telling you the world is changing and urging you to get on board with these changes if you don't want to be left behind. After all, the power of broke is about working harder, faster, smarter, and more efficiently. So let's take a look at one of the ways we can all be doing that, no matter where we live, who we know, or what industry or business we're trying to disrupt. And let's be clear, you don't have to be a tech visionary like my friend Gary Vaynerchuk. You don't have to be Jeff Bezos. You don't have to have millions of dollars in the bank or a bunch of seed money behind you. No, you just have to have the passion, ingenuity, hustle, and drive. An entrepreneurial heart. You have to have tapped the power of broke and found a way to put it out into the world. What did they used to say about Michael Dell? Word was that he couldn't operate a computer, so he told his engineers to come up with a product that even he can find a way to use. Me, I can't draw. I can sew a straight line, but that's about it. And somehow I was able to start my own clothing line. So don't tell me you can't do something or move into an area where you don't have any expertise. Just because you can't do it doesn't mean you can't do it. If basketball is your thing, and maybe you're a little short, a little slow, or can't cut it on the floor, there are still tons of ways for you to stay in the game, either as a coach, manager, front office guy, marketing guy, or whatever. Hard to believe how the world works these days, compared to how things were when we launched FUBU. Back then, if we wanted to get our shirts into the stores and onto the backs of our customers, we had to work through the major retailers. We had to get on the racks at Macy's or wherever because they had the distribution. Oh, we hit some of the smaller boutiques, especially in and around New York, but those numbers were never all that big. The problem was, to make any kind of profit, we had to get our line placed in these national chains. But for that to happen, we had to give up a bit of our street cred, which weakened our relationship with our customer. Forget what it did to our profit margins, because that was a part of the trade-off too. But the real cost to us over time was our authenticity. It pushed us further and further from the kid on the corner who was wearing our clothes because they spoke to him, because they were a reflection of who he was. National distribution, it came at a price. Cut to today, when it's now possible for brand owners and manufacturers to get the same kind of mass distribution without giving away the store and still keep those all-important customer relationships in force. Today, pretty much anyone can create a billion-dollar business sitting in her basement in the middle of nowhere, selling T-shirts or sneakers or socks, whatever she can stuff into a shipping box and send out into the world. In a relatively short stretch of time, the reach and power of the internet has turned startup businesses, and in fact, all businesses, on their head, to where now the only real commodity you need to start a business is not capital, it's creativity. That's a massive shift. You don't need to be born with a silver spoon in your mouth. You don't need to sweet talk your way into stores or cultivate important contacts. You don't need to spend big money on advertising to drive sales. You don't need to dig deep to bankroll a 3-month cart rental at your local mall. And you don't need to finance beyond your simple production cost. No, money is no longer the catalyst. You are the catalyst. Your ideas are the catalyst. And putting yourself and your ideas out into the marketplace has never been easier. Of course, by the same token, that marketplace has never been more competitive. Now that all those barriers to entry have come tumbling down, everybody and their mother is out there trying to make a sale. But I choose to look on this as a great, good thing. Why? Because it pushes us entrepreneurs to be the best we can be, to make sure our product or service stands apart, to strive to be the best of the best at whatever it is we've chosen to do. Let's face it, people. The moment we stopped asking, where can I buy it? Or when will it be made available in my community? Was the moment we started asking smarter, more relevant questions. What's your product like? What inspired you to make it? What are you passionate about? What's next? Really, this democratization of retail, that's a phrase I first heard from my friend Harley Finkelstein, the chief platform officer of Shopify, is probably the biggest thing to happen to retail since the invention of the credit card. It's changing the way we shop. And for our purposes here, it's changing the way we do business. This is another area where the power has shifted back to the people, to the customer and the small business owner alike. Because of companies like Square, you no longer have to go to the bank. You don't have to deal with stockbrokers or traders because you can execute your transactions online at little to no cost, and on and on. So what is Shopify? It's an online platform that enables merchants to sell their products directly to consumers without having to work with traditional retailers like Walmart, Sears, and Best Buy. They're not the only player in this space, but they represent one of the most exciting new developments in merchandising, and it comes at a time when our shopping malls are shutting down. Our big box chains are closing stores left and right. The business landscape is being transformed, and the consumer is driving that transformation. Think about it. We don't just want to buy online. We don't just want to buy in store. We want what we want when we want it. I repeat myself, I know, but it's an important point. This is the world those folks in that bathtub have made for us. This is the world we live in today. And just as consumers are learning to adapt to this new world, the business community is adapting as well. Through platforms like Shopify, which now hosts over 165,000 online stores with aggregate sales of over $8 billion. That's a big, big number. How big? More than half the countries of the world have a gross national product of less than $8 billion. That's how big. And that number is growing every year. So clearly, Shopify has tapped into something. As my friend Harley Finkelstein puts it, the future of selling is retail everywhere. For example, if Best Buy wants to sell to you, they should have a wonderful online store, because that's how you want to buy it. If they want to sell to your father, he might want to go into a store, pick up a camera, play with it, feel the weight of it, and then maybe go home and buy it from his iPad while he's sitting on his couch. He wants a little bit of a combined experience. And then, all the way at the other end of the spectrum, you might have your grandfather. And if Best Buy wants to sell to him, they'll have to have knowledgeable salespeople on the floor to help him understand the product. And they need to be set up so your grandfather can pay for the item in cash and walk out the door with it. The point is, for the first time in history, it's the consumer who dictates to the retailer how he or she wants to buy. A lot of people, they have this debate, Harley says. They think it's a question of online versus offline, but that's not what we're seeing. What we're seeing is retail everywhere. It's the customer calling the shots. It's all so exciting to hear this type of thinking from someone on the front lines of this change. Really, I could listen to this guy talk about the future of retail for hours. In fact, I direct my Shark Tank partners to Harley's platform all the time, and I steer my Game Changer meeting clients his way as well. More and more, the merchants who pitch us on the show are using online platforms like Shopify to reach their customers and make their first sales. Or maybe they're taking a page from Linda Johansson James's playbook and setting up a short-term cart rental in a nearby shopping mall. However they choose to sell their products, it's clear to them that the power has shifted back to the people in today's economy. These days, there are even barcode scanning apps that let you check in an instant if a product is available at a better price at a nearby store. And if you twist their arms, buyers for Best Buy, just to give you an example, are so mindful of this transfer of power, they won't even stock a single item in a category. What do I mean by that? If you sell electronic scooters, say, and you have the very best electronic scooter on the market, Best Buy won't carry your product unless they also carry two other brands. Why? Because their research shows that customers will just wind up checking out your scooter and hoofing it on home to buy it online. Make no mistake, we call the shots as customers more than ever before, and the businesses that get out in front of this shift are the ones that'll prosper. Seek new sources of revenue, new methods of delivery. For those practicing the power of broke, the incredibly low cost of today's technology offers incredible opportunities to get your business off the ground or your foot in the door. By now, I'm betting most of you have heard the term crowdfunding, a relatively new term that refers to the way folks are now funding their new products or ventures with an assist from a global community of investors through websites like Kickstarter, Indiegogo, GoFundMe, and Seed Invest. According to Wikipedia, monies generated through crowdfunding sites for projects based in the United States alone topped $5 billion in 2013. That's a lot of paper. But what gets me excited is the way these sites help to generate interest in a product when it's still in development. Typically, one of these online appeals is built around some kind of pitch video, which gives a brief background on the project and shows why the money is needed and how it would be spent. Some sites allow investors to give as little as $1, and some try to get you to give in round number chunks like $100, $500, or $1,000. Most times, the entrepreneur behind the pitch will offer some kind of creative incentive to generate donations. For example, a writer I know was out to raise $5,000 to fund a self-published young adult novel, and he offered to name a character in his book after you if you gave at a certain level. Another entrepreneur who saw $30,000 to design a new type of performance pouch that would allow runners and outdoor enthusiasts to easily hold their wallet, their keys, and their cell phone while they were out for a run or a hike, offered to send a finished prototype to anybody who donated $20 or more to her campaign.
Power fact. Since 2009, small firms have accounted for 60% of new jobs. Doesn't matter if your sales figures are in the hundreds, the thousands, or the millions. Small business is big business.
This last type of pitch has been a particularly effective way for merchants to pre-sell an item and bypass the conventional retail model. Not only do you make your first sale, but you've generated real engagement by inviting your first customers into the process. Back in the day, we didn't know the first thing about our FUBU customers. All we knew was what we could see on the streets, in the clubs, who was wearing our clothes, and how they were wearing them. But nowadays, we know everything about our customers. We've got their whole profile online. And when we engage with crowdfunding sites like Kickstarter, we're harnessing a new type of sales power. We're not only creating investors, we're building our customer base. The people who participate in these campaigns are more than just customers. They've become fans with a rooting interest in your success. And now you've collected their names and email addresses and set it up so they want to keep hearing from you as you develop and refine new products and services. The whole process of crowdfunding is proof of concept at its best. How it works is you come up with a prototype version of your product, market test it, and find a way to get it into the hands of a core group of vested investors, all before you release it to the general public. In this way, you're able to get a good handle on inventory and keep your costs down, while at the same time seeding the marketplace. While I was writing this part of the book, I went looking online for an example of a project that really took off via crowdfunding, way beyond the entrepreneur's wildest dreams. One success story in particular pretty much blew me away. Have you heard of Honeyflow? It's a clever innovation in the beekeeping, honey extracting business, Honey on Tap, and it was developed by a father-son team in Australia. In March 2015, Honeyflow launched a fundraising campaign on the Indiegogo site, looking to raise $70,000. This was the amount they thought they needed to grow their business to the next level, an affordable next step, a goal within reach. When the campaign closed a month later, they'd earned over $12 million in pledges from more than 36,000 customers all over the world, making it the largest, most successful campaign in Indiegogo history at the time. Those are astonishing numbers, especially when you consider the expectations going in. And what's interesting here is that these guys didn't just come out of nowhere. They'd been testing their special hives for years with beekeepers. So they'd been fine-tuning and market-testing their product along the way. But in less than a month, they were able to make the kind of splash it would have cost millions to make a decade earlier. And now, they had a way to get the product directly into the backyards and gardens of thousands of customers who'd essentially prepaid for the privilege of receiving one of the first hives once the company began full production. But here's the best part. They did this at virtually no cost, beyond the cost of producing an informative 5-minute video to explain their product and introduce potential investors to the wonders of beekeeping and the pleasures of harvesting your own honey. But that doesn't mean these guys didn't work hard to get where they are. Quite the opposite. If you've never conducted one of these crowdfunding campaigns before, it might seem like easy pickings, but that's hardly the case. You can't just slap a video together, pass around the hat, and expect folks to donate. That's not how it works. You've only got one shot here, so it pays to take some time with it. After all, the more you put into any initiative, the more you'll get back in return. And these Honeyflow guys are a great illustration of that. They busted their butts, refining their product, testing it in the field, collecting feedback from farmers and beekeepers at every step. And at the other end, when they finally got around to passing the hat, the Indiegogo community rewarded them like crazy, all because they'd taken the time to do it right, because they needed to do it right. And as a result, they found success way sweeter than any honey they're likely to harvest. Have a goal in mind. Actually, have several. I'm a firm believer in setting goals. The thing of it is, too often a lot of us let others set negative goals for us. What do I mean by that? Well, we let ourselves become convinced that we can't get the girl, we won't get the job, we'll never get rich. We take in all those negatives, and that becomes our baseline. There was even an interesting study conducted by a linguistics and anthropology professor at Penn State that determined the 7 most common words to describe human emotions in English and Spanish. Those words were joy, fear, anger, sadness, disgust, shame, and guilt. Think about that for a moment. 7 words, and only one of them describes a positive emotion. So that tells us we've been conditioned to think in a negative. Goal setting. Positive goal setting is one way to change that. I've been doing it since I was 14 years old, around the time I first read Napoleon Hill's great book, Think and Grow Rich. That book was a game changer for me, especially since it was such a challenge for me to get through it. Remember, nobody had any idea that I was dyslexic when I was a kid. We just knew that I struggled in school, struggled to keep up with my reading. But for some reason, I was drawn to this book, and I could never figure out why I kept reaching for it. I liked it so much that every year or so, I decided to reread it. But I realize now that this was probably because I wasn't retaining everything from the previous time. Every time I opened that book, there was something new. But the goal-setting piece came through the very first time. Once I started setting positive goals instead of negative ones, my life changed completely. Don't know how exactly, but there was definitely a connection. I would write something down, think about it, visualize it, and work my way toward it. And over the years, I kept at it. Only, I've since come up with my own style. The visualization piece was a real key for me. I'd start by picturing whatever I was trying to achieve. When you've got a tangible, accessible goal, you've put it within reach.
Power fact. According to a Harvard Business School study, 83% of the population does not take the time to set professional goals. Now, 14% have goals in mind, but they don't even write them down. 3% actually write down their goals on paper and they commit to them. Right away, you can see that if you simply make a record of your goals, you'll be ahead of the game. But get this, the 14% with goals in mind are 10 times more successful than those with no goals at all. While the 3% who write down their goals are 3 times more successful than the ones with the unwritten goals. What's the takeaway? It's a no-brainer. Write down those goals.
So that's one kind of goal setting. You close your eyes and picture it. But these days, I'm all about writing down my goals on a piece of paper. At any given time, I'll have about 7 goals that I spend some time with about 5 days each week. I try to give myself 2 days in there where I could just relax, refresh. I'll read over these goals at night so they're the last thing I think about before I go to sleep. Sometimes this helped me to dream about them. That's the idea. Then I'll read them again in the morning, first thing. And the idea here is that I can hopefully make a small step forward in each of these areas if I set everything in motion before the rest of the day runs away from me. Also, I put an expiration date on my goals, a clock. Some of them expire in a couple weeks. Some of them in a couple months. Some I give myself years to see all the way through. When I write the goal down, I say what I want, the date I want it by, and a couple lines on how I'm going to get there and what kinds of things I'm prepared to give up or give back in order to do so. At age 20, I might have written down that I wanted to go from selling hats to selling t-shirts to selling hockey jerseys on a certain timetable. Or maybe that I wanted to be in a certain number of stores by the following Christmas. Right now, I have a health-related goal to get down to 170 pounds by July 4. How do I plan to do that? I'm drinking 8 glasses of water a day, avoiding food after 7 o'clock at night, and cutting down on fried foods, meats, and alcohol. The folks who study this type of thing will tell you this is not the way to state your objectives. You're not supposed to say what you're planning to avoid. The focus is meant to be on what you will do and not on what you won't do. So, to be clear, I plan to reach my goal by only eating fish, drinking only iced tea and water, and exercising 2 times a day. With me, I always have a health goal, a family goal, a business goal, a relationship goal, and a philanthropy goal. Sometimes there'll be a goal about achieving a certain type of work-life balance, or maybe a secondary business goal, especially now that I'm in Shark Tank mode and I've got all these different projects occupying my attention. Sometimes there'll be a goal about financial security or setting aside money for my kids. Whatever it is, I keep it specific, and I try to keep in mind the visualization techniques I learned when I got started on the habit, because after all, you can't hit a target you don't see. Get with the program. These days, one of my biggest areas of concern is the so-called digital gap in the workplace. The term refers to the way certain workers are left behind if they don't have the digital skills to compete. It's a problem for a lot of our older workers especially, and I mention it here because broke is no excuse for getting left behind in this area. The same way you're never too broke to find a way around a roadblock in your business, you're never too old to get past any digital roadblocks you might find in your path.
Power fact. People between the ages of 55 and 64 have the highest rate of entrepreneurship in America. Listen, it's never too late or too early to follow your dreams and start a business. But do yourself a favor and get started on it right away.
Consider these trends, which I pulled up from a recent study funded by Capital One as part of its Future Edge program to help folks succeed in a digitally driven economy. 8 out of 10 middle-skilled jobs require some form of digital skills. Middle-skilled jobs requiring a level of digital expertise are growing at a faster rate than other middle-skilled jobs. Jobs requiring digital skills pay higher wages, an average of 18% higher. Middle-skilled jobs requiring no level of digital expertise are growing at the slowest rate of all, slower even than low-skilled jobs. Now, I'm not suggesting that we all need to be able to code, but we all do need to get with the program. I'm thinking here of someone in my parents' generation, a smart, creative, older person who will be an asset to any office environment. But because he or she might have trouble doing even simple things on a computer, they'll be boxed out of certain opportunities. And what about those diligent blue-collar workers who suddenly find themselves out of work after 30 years? Factory workers, shipping clerks, cab drivers, bartenders. If they can't use QuickBooks or conduct a simple search online, they're in trouble. Plain talk, you'll never make manager if you don't know how to use an accounting program like QuickBooks. You'll always be on the cash register. You'll always be on fries. And forget about just lifting yourself up from a minimum wage job onto a management track. Without the most basic digital skills, a college degree and years of management experience can't help you out. You leave yourself at the mercy of others to design your website, handle your IT needs, coordinate your social networking fees. We've reached a point where you're either on the bus or you're off the bus. And I suggest you pay the fare and get on board. Take a couple of classes and get yourself up to speed, because these jobs are not about to come looking for you. Keep the power. Know this. No matter how old you are, the power of broke never leaves you. It's not something you outgrow, outpace, or out-earn. It's not something you can shake once you get a couple of bucks in the bank. No, it gets in your DNA. And that's a good thing, because you'll almost certainly need to call on it throughout your career. Anyway, it's sure in my DNA, and I can't imagine a time when I'll look out at the world in a different way. Although, got to admit, I've slipped from time to time. I'll give you an example. My first year on Shark Tank, I lost a bunch of money because I found myself making decisions in ways I've never made them before. I was spread thin, with all these new demands on my time, so a lot of times I would just throw money at a problem and hope that would take care of it. But of course, that's not how it works, right? Another thing, the deal flow that first season wasn't what it would become. A lot of pitches we were hearing were pretty thin, and a lot of the startups we were seeing on the show hadn't really started up just yet. Either the concepts were way out there, or the proof of concept wasn't where it needed to be, or the people behind these young businesses needed just a little more time to get things going. The show's producers have gotten better over the years at vetting the entrepreneurs who come on air, but back then, we were kind of scrambling. Still, each of us on the panel made a number of deals, and we had to do our due diligence on them and follow through. That first year, I think I closed about 50% of the deals I'd reached on the show. Meaning, after the entrepreneur had been in the tank with us, everything checked out in only about half the cases. And so we only ended up going into business with that 50% after the cameras stopped rolling. Some of those deals unraveled owing to a simple case of buyer's remorse. I was learning that the excitement of the show could sometimes lead to a bidding war amongst us sharks, but most of them fell apart because the numbers didn't check out. In all, I put in about $750,000 of my own money that first year that I've yet to get back. Why? Because I let the power of broke get away from me. How? Well, for one thing, I was getting killed on the legal end. For those first deals, I was using the law firm I always use, but they weren't really set up to help me vet these small companies. The firm was happy to take my money, but I was paying way more for their services than the deals themselves could justify. And the services they were offering didn't really cover everything I needed. Nothing against this one firm. Hey, I continue to use them for the rest of my business, but this wasn't their strength. No, I needed to work with a venture capital firm where they had software and systems in place to do this kind of thing. Only I didn't realize the value they would bring because they do it all at a fraction of the cost. So by the second season, I was able to cut my legal bills down from $200,000 to about $30,000. A major savings just in terms of raw dollars, but an enormous difference on a percentage basis. Also, I realized I needed to hire a support staff to assist me in running these small companies. I needed someone to help me on the licensing front, on the marketing front, on the social media front. All these different experts, when I was hiring them on an as-needed basis that first year, their fees were killing me. It's not that these good people were overcharging me, because these were the market rates, but I was definitely overpaying. Can you see the difference? Plus, it was tough to keep track of it all. I needed to bring all those businesses, all those opportunities, under one roof. All along, I should have put together a full-time team, given my people some sweat equity in these companies, and kept my costs down. Me, of all people, I should have known this going in, because I lost a bunch of money in previous years on similar deals and partnerships when I didn't have this kind of support in place. It started out, I was just throwing money at this new situation. But it wasn't until I was watching all that money slip through my fingers that I realized I had to change things up. In other words, it took being broke to get me to look for another way to grow my business. And the bonus here was that once I had my team in place, a licensing expert, a business affairs person, a lawyer, a digital marketing person, someone to ride herd on contracts, someone to run point and interference for me, I was able to pursue similar deals away from the show, growing my business in ways I hadn't even anticipated and helping to spread those overhead costs across a number of different properties. It took me a while, but I figured it out eventually. So that's why I say the power of broke never leaves you. It might run and hide every once in a while, and you might get a little too full of yourself to call on it, but it's there. Better believe it's there. Before I let you go and reflect on the lessons of powerful people you've met in this book, people who are just like you, one way or another, I want to introduce you to one last person, Mark Burnett, who's been my boss these past few years as the producer of Shark Tank. Yeah, you heard me. My boss. Everybody answers to somebody, right? But I'll let you in on a little secret. Mark's not my toughest boss. Not even close. That honor? It goes to my number one boss, the customer. Anyway, I'm closing with Mark's story because there are a ton of similarities to my own, as you're about to see. He comes from a neighborhood of hardworking families. His folks had to sometimes work two or three jobs to keep food on the table. He learned early on the power of positive thinking, goal setting, perseverance, all that good stuff. From his mother, he learned that regret can be a powerful motivator too. He was always hearing about the opportunities his parents had let slip away. And like me, he didn't want to grow up telling those same stories on himself. He was inspired by people like Tony Robbins and Donald Trump, just like me. He got his start selling t-shirts, just like me. And out of all of that, he found a way to build on his spirit of adventure to become the most successful producer in the history of reality television. In fact, a lot of folks credit him with actually creating the genre, and I'm not about to argue with them. So take a look at how Mark got to where he is today, which in a sidelong way has a lot to do with how I got here. Be adventurous. Survive and thrive. Mark Burnett, television producer, best-selling author. If you're smarter than a fifth grader, you can become an apprentice, then a contender. Out of that, hopefully, you'll be put through your paces and become a survivor. By the time you become a shark, you will have certainly found your voice. Okay, so here's where I get to suck up to the boss. Only, not really, because Mark Burnett has more broke in his backstory than just about anybody in this book. These days, you might know Mark as one of the most successful television producers in the business. Time magazine calls him one of the world's most influential people, with almost 3,000 hours of primetime content to his credit, including shows like Shark Tank, Survivor, The Apprentice, and The Voice. But what most fans of these shows don't know is that he started out in a working-class suburb of London with just enough to get by. His father worked a night shift at the local Ford plant. His mother worked a late shift in the car battery factory next door. Basically, he grew up in a factory town where almost every house was identical. Folks had the same jobs, the same dreams, the same circumstances. "I never noticed that we didn't have any money," he says, "because everyone was in the same boat." That's how it is in a lot of hardworking families. Mom and dad work like crazy to put food on the table and keep a roof overhead, and the kids don't even notice the sacrifice, at least not right away. When money's tight, they take on extra work, and the kids don't always notice that either. But Mark noticed, even as a kid, he paid attention to the details, to the story behind the story. That's one of the skills that make him such a success in television. He's such a great storyteller, and here he's got a great story to tell, his own. One of the stories behind the story he picked up on was a theme of regret that seemed to run through his house. "My mom was always talking about how they should have started a business," he remembers, "or they should have saved their money and opened up a pub. She was always dreaming about something bigger, something better." The takeaway for Mark was that he didn't want to have those same feelings of regret when it came to making his own way in the world. That fear of missing out, of leaving an opportunity on the table, is what drove him, he says. "A lot of people, they're afraid to try something new because they're afraid to fail," he reflects. "For them, the fear of failure is so great, they wind up taking ordinary jobs, living ordinary lives. But my fear was something else." Everybody has a fear, right? Most people, they're either rushing towards a pleasure experience or they're running away from a fear experience. And you have to decide, what's your motivator? "My motivator was the fear of looking back and regretting that I didn't take one of these risks my mom was always talking about. My pain was the fear of future regret. So I didn't care so much whether things worked out. I only cared that I took the action and tried." Don't look back. Mark's first course of action was a stint in the military, in a parachute regiment where the work ethic he'd learned from his parents was kicked into an even higher gear. He was surrounded by hard charger, no excuses types. He even saw some action in Northern Ireland and in the Falklands. And this environment, too, set him up for the future role as a television producer, where an entire production team will be looking to him for leadership. At the end of his service, Mark started thinking about his next move, and what he kept coming back to was what he didn't want to do. Like a lot of folks just starting out, he could rule things out, but he couldn't focus in on any one goal. Basically, he knew he didn't want to work in a factory like his parents. He didn't want to miss out on any opportunities. "My dad worked all his life," Mark says, "and he was getting paid £40 a week, the same pay I was making in the Army. I thought there had to be something more." Now, here's where Mark's path took a surprising turn. At least that's how it seemed to me when I first heard the story. You see, following his military service, he took a job as a live-in housekeeper slash nanny for a family in Malibu. How's that for a pivot? A guy with his background, a badass who served in two wars, moving into some rich family's house to work as a domestic? But to hear Mark tell it, the move made perfect sense once he decided to relocate to Los Angeles. He had no money, no car, no place to live. By his calculations, it was exactly the sort of job he should be taking, so he grabbed at it. Really, he didn't care if he was flipping burgers, cleaning toilets, or taking care of kids in a big old house. Long as he was moving towards something. And here it worked out that the guy he was working for owned an insurance company, so Mark started working for him at the office too. This wasn't the best fit, Mark soon realized. "I never sold anything in my life," he says, "and I didn't like the idea of asking people for money, so I was starting to think it might not work out." But what Mark saw early on was that he had an ability to connect with people. And soon he found himself putting that ability to work along a stretch of Venice Beach. Doing what? Selling t-shirts, baby. Just like his future shark used to do outside the New York Coliseum. Way, way, way before FUBU. You see, Mark wasn't prepared to give up on this insurance company gig just yet, but he was determined to make some extra money, build up his nut, so he figured out a way to make money slinging clothes. The way it worked was, he'd go downtown to Los Angeles and seek out these damaged shirts from well-known brands that were selling in Macy's and Nordstrom. For $2, he could get a shirt that would typically sell for $30 or $40. Slightly damaged, he could usually get half price, meaning $15 or $20. Not a bad markup. It started out, he was just selling on the weekends, but the money got too good to limit himself to Saturdays and Sundays. Trouble was, expanding his business meant taking on some additional cost and cutting off the sure thing with his insurance gig. First, the additional cost. He needed to rent 15 feet of linear space in front of someone's garden fence on one of the main drags by the beach. It was the cost of doing business, basically. There was a ton of foot traffic, and he could hang his display shirts on the fence to catch people's attention. Also, the longer he was outside with his inventory, the more he had to deal with weather damage and dirt and wear and tear. "I'd make a great profit on about half those shirts," he says, "but then I'd have to get rid of the rest, whatever I can get, because those shirts would get so grubby, people trying them on. I was happy to get just a dollar or two on those and regenerate the money." Do the math. The only way Mark could justify the $1,500 monthly rent was to work every day. He figured $50 a day was a reasonable overhead, working 7 days a week. Compare that to just 2 days a week, and it came out to a day rate of about $150, a tough number to justify. Finally, it got to where Mark had to go to his boss and tell him how much he appreciated the opportunity, selling insurance, but that he had to move on. "I was so nervous telling him I wanted to leave," Mark remembers. "After all the kindness he'd shown to me, but I was making more money on this t-shirt thing just on the weekends when I was just starting out than I was making a whole week working in this guy's office." Turned out, the guy couldn't have been happier for Mark. Couldn't have been more proud. Mark, still relatively new to the United States, thought this mindset was typical of his adopted country. He says, "Here's the perfect example of an American so happy for someone else's success. It's a nation of encouragers, really. It's a nation, I think, built on two things, faith and free enterprise." Funnily enough, in my job, I went on to produce The Bible and Shark Tank, so I'm in both worlds. But this philosophy I had of wanting to take chances and not worrying about it if it didn't work out, it might have come from the example of my parents, but it was reinforced here in America. During this time, on slow days at the beach, Mark used to read business and self-help books between customers. He was reading Donald Trump's The Art of the Deal, never imagining he would work with the Donald one day on the Apprentice franchise. He also scraped together enough money to attend a couple Tony Robbins seminars, never imagining he would one day count Tony among his closest friends. "Tony's thing was to write down a list," Mark tells me, "an outrageous list of your hopes and dreams and what excites you. At the top of the list, Mark wrote down adventure, only he didn't quite know what to do with that word. For now, he just filed it away. But because he'd taken the time to write it down, it stayed with him in a meaningful way." At some point, Mark realized he wasn't going to get rich selling t-shirts. He could make good money, but there was a ceiling to it, and he wasn't interested in the ceiling. "Look where I came from," he says. "I started out making $125 a week as a nanny, living in someone's house, taking care of their kids. And now I was making a couple $1,000s a week with a place of my own. I was living the American dream, but I wasn't done dreaming." One of the great motivators for Mark? Women. Hey, let's tell it like it is. He was out and about one night with a guy who had a development deal at Sony. The guy had never made a movie, but he had a development deal, so he could go to parties and clubs and say he was in the movie business. Mark could say he sold t-shirts. Guess who got the most play? "That guy made less money than I made," Mark remembers, "but he certainly had an office on a movie lot. So naturally, I thought that'd be a really cool business to be in. The girls I was meeting, they weren't interested in a guy who sold t-shirts." Meanwhile, in the back of his mind, Mark kept thinking of that word, adventure. And now he tried to attach it in some way to the entertainment business. This thirst for adventure took him to the famous Raid Adventure Race in Costa Rica, after he'd read an article about the event's founder in the Los Angeles Times. He put together a team and entered the competition, again, driven by that no-regrets motto that runs through his whole life. He ended up competing in two raid events, and somewhere in there, he got an idea to license the format and stage a similar event in North America. Out of that, he started the Eco Challenge, a premier adventure competition that required five-person teams to kayak, trek, horseback ride, and mountain bike over a rugged 300-mile course. The first event was held in a Utah desert in 1995, and it proved so popular that Mark found a way to sell the rights to cable television. Here, Mark's power-broke attitude kicked into high gear, because he had a clear idea how he wanted to capture the event on camera. He wanted the show to look unlike anything else on television, to show the thrill of the chase, the adventure. To do this, he decided, he needed to hire a helicopter to shoot from the sky. But the folks at the Discovery Channel, who controlled the budget, wouldn't authorize the shoot. So what did Mark do? He charged a helicopter to his credit card. He didn't have the money to pay for it, but he really, really wanted that helicopter shot. And so he figured he would sort it out later. These days, you can use a drone for a lot less money, he says, but I felt we needed that shot. We needed to have a different look. In the end, you have to go with your instincts. No regrets, right? You just step to it and go. Go out of your way. Jump ahead a bunch of years to Survivor, which, as you may have guessed by now, basically came out of those Eco Challenge broadcasts. And Mark was still trying to stretch his budget in a way that would make his show stand out. Remember, one of the great conceits of Survivor was that each season was filmed in a different exotic location, a premise he borrowed from his Eco Challenge format, by the way. But for the first season, he was scrambling. Once again, he called on the power of broke. Basically, I needed to find an island, he says, and I needed to get someone else to pay for it. And as I was researching and researching, I saw that Malaysia had just started a tourism campaign, so I made a call to the Malaysian government. He didn't just make a call. He made an ask. A big ask. I told them I needed 5 business class tickets, 5 hotel rooms, and the use of a helicopter to scout locations. He says, the response, he got everything he asked for, and a little bit more besides. The tourism board also kicked in a location manager to help Mark and his team tour the country. The reason Mark got what he needed on this, it was the art of the pitch. He found a way to match his needs to the needs of the Malaysian government. He knew that a primetime CBS television show highlighting exotic Malaysian locations would be a boon to the country's tourism industry. So he could pitch a win-win situation. End of the day, Mark believes his success in television flows directly from the fear of regret that has driven him his entire life. Also, his thirst for adventure and his determination to surround himself with people who share in that thirst. That's the one factor I look for in deciding to work with someone, he says. I want to see energy. I learned that in the Army. I learned that during the Eco Challenge. I learned that with Survivor. I learned that from my friend Donald Trump, who once told me it's the one quality he looks for in a new hire. He said you could have a great education, a degree from Harvard, but what he wants to know most of all is if that person has limitless energy. Will he keep going, no matter what?
Power fact. 97% of the entrepreneurs who give up become employed by the 3% who never quit. I'm not even sure if I should say any more about this.
That kind of relentless energy is really about perseverance, right? And here Mark reaches for one of his favorite biblical passages from the book of Romans to illustrate. Suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character. And character, hope. Really, he says, if you have hope in anything you do, you can make it.
Mark's key shark point, adore what you do. With Mark, It's all about the adventure. He knew he wasn't cut out for a desk job. He knew he wanted to make money, see the world, soak in new experiences. He took the example of his parents, hard work and discipline, and went another way with it. Oh, he works harder than anyone I know. He's got more discipline than anyone I know. But he approaches work from a place of joy. He's one of those guys who's up for anything. And this, too, comes from his parents. Only here, it comes from making sure he doesn't have any of their regrets. That's a powerful motivator, don't you think? I want you to think back about all these shark points throughout the book, and you'll see that each and every one of them can be applied to each and every one of the innovators and entrepreneurs we've met in these pages. And since this is the last profile in the book, I'm hoping you get it by now, that each and every one of these shark points can also be applied to you. Set a goal. Do your homework. Adore what you do. Remember, you are the brand. Keep swimming. I want you to know that the power of broke can take you to the same levels of success that found these good people. So what are you waiting for?
A final thought. Bringing it all home. Before I sign off, I want to help you take some of the stories and principles we've covered in this book and find a way to attach them to your own lives. After all, the great lessons of the game-changing individuals you've met in these pages are intended to inspire you to do some game-changing of your own. Okay, so what's the big takeaway here? Well, the bottom line message beneath each mega success story is that broke only breaks you if you let it. But broke can make you too, if you let it. And even better, if you find a way to leverage the power of broke, it can become a mammoth springboard and a driver of unimaginable business, financial, and personal achievement. Hopefully, in reading between the lines and looking behind the curtain at the lives of these pioneering individuals, you've gone from a place of uncertainty, wondering just how you'll get from 0 to 60 when 0 seems to have a hold on you, to a place of infinite possibility. Through these real profiles of real people accomplishing really, really cool things, you've seen how these remarkably resilient, resourceful, and relentlessly driven individuals have used the power of broke to fuel their resolve and to help them build an iconic billion-dollar brand, an outrageously successful chain of cupcake shops, and a compelling social media platform. And you've seen how in each case, they've harnessed the power of broke to change their attitude and altitude of vision, possibility, and focus. And so as we prepare to close the book on these lessons, let's take this final opportunity to highlight our main points so you can carry these lessons forward and build your own high-performance, high-achievement growth strategies to serve you mightily in your business, in your relationships, in your performance potential, and in any part of your life. If you're like me, you'll want to take these lessons and post them on your bathroom mirror, on your refrigerator, on your dashboard, on your desktop. Wherever it is that it will catch your full attention on a daily basis because, hey, there's nothing like constant reinforcement to get you going. So here we go. Here are the broke power principles pulled from the lives of the trailblazing individuals I've just introduced to you. Broke power principle number one. Use all the resources available to you, but don't expect to just flip a switch and get them all cranking on autopilot. No, you've got to learn how to best use these resources to your smartest advantage, especially if you're tapping into those OPM-type resources my good friend Jay Abraham talked about earlier. Other people's money, other people's mindset, and other people's magic. Broke power principle number two. Keep it real. Strive for authenticity in everything you do. At the end of the day, the more humility and integrity you put out into the world, the more you'll connect with others who want to help you succeed. Broke power principle number three. Learn and embrace the power of optimization. By that, I mean make the very best use of your time, energy, actions, opportunity cost, and capital. One of the most precious resources available to you at absolutely no cost is time. Don't waste it. Broke power principle number 4. Understand that you will be rewarded for solving other people's problems or filling holes in the marketplace, just as you will be rewarded for helping others reach their desired objectives. In other words, if you could figure out how to do something better, faster, easier, and more efficiently than anybody else, and if you could make somebody else's life a little smoother in the bargain, you're way ahead of the game. Broke power principle number 5. Put all your passion and purpose behind whatever it is you're doing. And if you don't believe in yourself, in your product, your service, or your business, you can't expect anyone else to either. That said, you don't want to come across as a nut, so don't be fanatical or unreasonably optimistic. Remember that you're selling people on the ideal of trusting in you, because people invest in people, not just in a product or service. Broke power principle number 6. Take the time to understand and appreciate everyone you meet on your path to success. Investor, distributor, vendor, prospective buyer, or customer, whoever it is, show him or her that you get how things are from their perspective. Tell them that you're rooting for them. Show them that you have their best interest in mind. They will respect you for respecting their reality. And who knows, maybe they'll go out of their way to do the same for you. Broke power principle number 7. Think beyond the moment. This can be tough to do, especially when you're up against it. Find a way to support your vision with logic, data, and realistic projections. Wishful thinking and conjecture have a way of working against you and breaking you in a bad way. Broke power principle number 8. Make the probability of your success a natural part of your thinking. Expect it. Will it so? Why? Because good things come to those who expect them. Now, that doesn't mean that we only make room in our thinking for pie-in-the-sky outcomes. See broke power principle number 7. No, this means you need to train yourself to keep your goals in sight and in reach. It means that you must believe wholeheartedly that your success is within you. Keep this thought at the front of your mind. Let it drive every action you take. Learn from these stories I've shared with you and model your approach to these successful individuals. Each and every one of them had a low point, and yet each and every one of them found a way to pick themselves up and move on. Know that you can too. Know that you must. Tell me, what are your broke power principles? I encourage you to share them with me at damonjohn.com/powerofbroke, and I promise to pass them along and share them with all of you, together with a whole bunch of new ones I'm sure I'll come up with now that I'm thinking along these lines. Are you ready to put these principles to work? That's great. Before I let you go, I want to ask you to look one more time at the shark points we've hit in each one of these profiles. They're basic, so basic, in fact, that you should probably find a way to hardwire your thinking to make room for them. In some way or other, they should be at the heart of everything you do. Set a goal. Do your homework. Adore what you do. Remember, you are the brand. Keep swimming. Now, I don't expect you to master each of these points and principles right away, so why not start by picking one that you believe is within reach? Imprint it on your brain. Commit to it fully. Then go out and put it to work for you. And once you've got that one done, get to work on another one. And as you do so, expect it to be a little bit hard. It's not always easy to try something new. Anything beyond your comfort level or outside your experience will take some getting used to. But I'm betting on you to figure it all out and go at your own pace and get up to speed before too long. We were all babies once, right? We've all taken baby steps. That's how we learn to walk, to talk, to eat, to ride a bicycle, and to program our smartphones. There's no shame in taking baby steps here either. Build up to your first goal and work at it until you get it right, until it becomes natural, perpetual, and authentic. And then, once you've got it down, once you're feeling comfortable and competent, you can move on to the next one, and the next. Do this, and you'll do yourself and your business a massive solid. Trust me on this. Do this, and you'll push yourself closer to where you want to be. Do this, and you'll have tapped into the